Hello everyone, welcome to the third episode of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Mohammad Mustafa Hussein, a professor of electrical engineering and computer science of University of California, Berkeley. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest today is someone whose passion to understand and then to explain carrier transport for semiconductor devices, especially at the nanoscale, has illuminated all of us to build better semiconductor devices and to implement them in everyday life. Mark Lundstrom is the Don and Carol Skipfris Distinguished Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Purdue University. After receiving his BEE and MSEE degrees from the University of Minnesota in 1973 and 1974, he joined Hewlett-Packard, or HP, where he worked on integrated circuit process development and manufacturing. He received his PhD from Purdue and joined the faculty in 1980. Lundstrom's career has been marked by a tight connection of research and education, focusing on the physics, modeling, and numerical simulation of semiconductor devices. Professor Lundstrom's research on interdigitated back contact solar cells contributed to a design that was invented by Dean of Engineering Emeritus Richard Shorts and that is now widely used by solar cell manufacturers. His proposal to exploit photon recycling is the basis for today's highest efficiency single junction solar cells. Lundstrom's work on semiconductor heterostructures developed techniques that are now embodied in semiconductor CAD tools. Near the turn of the century, when MOSFET channel lengths were 250 nanometer, Professor Lundstrom's pioneering studies of quantum transport were the first to show the nanoscale MOSFETs would continue to operate as classical transistors at channel lengths below 10 nanometers. Today, a simple, elegant conceptual model he developed to explain these results is widely used to guide transistor research and development. Professor Lundstrom also did groundbreaking research on novel electronic devices such as carbon nanotube, graphene, and nanowire transistors. He and his colleague, Professor Supriya Datta, shared the 2002 IEEE Cledo Brunetti Award for this work. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. You know, I'll turn 70 in June, and I'm healthy and active and feeling good. As you know, I recently completed a one-year term as acting dean of engineering here, and I'm really looking forward now to having some time to think about semiconductors again.
That is going to be really great for everyone. Every time you have stepped in, you have stepped up. We have been benefited as the people who pursue electron devices as our passion. At the same time, overall, the society has been impacted. And that's why we would like to know a little more about you today. And that's why we're having this conversation. How was your childhood, your school life? What are the memories that you still cherish fondly? And at the same time, anything that you regret?
Well, I grew up in a very small town in Minnesota, and it was a really good place to grow up. You know, we didn't have a lot of money, but you didn't need very much. You know, in the summer, I'd play baseball in the morning. In the afternoon, I'd swim in one of the 200 lakes within 10 miles of the city. In the winter, we would go ice skating, sledding, or fishing on a frozen lake. So it was really a wonderful place. You know, I was interested in science right from the beginning, I guess. I would shoot off model rockets. I would tinker around with radios. I ground my own mirror and made myself an 8-inch reflecting telescope. So it was really a great place to grow up. You know, it was full of good, hardworking, down-to-earth people. I was lucky.
It really sounds very interesting. And I don't think that anyone can have any regret after having that kind of experience. How was your graduate life?
Well, I can tell you about my graduate student life because, you know, I never planned to go to graduate school, right? That was never in my thinking. That was my mother had never gone to college. My father had not completed college. I was just going to go to college and get a bachelor's degree. But in my junior year at the University of Minnesota, I took an electronics course with Eldert van der Zeele. So he was a very famous person in electronic noise, you know, a physicist by training. And for some reason, he asked me to work in his lab 10 hours a week. And by working in his lab, that was the first time I saw what graduate students did. And that kind of led me to stay. I decided I would stay one more year and get a master's degree. And that was a pretty intense year for me because everyone took 2 years to get a master's degree. And I did an experimental thesis. It was on spin waves and surface acoustic wave devices. I learned all of the challenges of doing experimental work and how frustrating it can be, but also the joy you experience when things finally work. My very first publication, a 1975 Applied Physics Letters, came out of that work. Now, near the end of my master's degree, my thesis advisor gave me some very good advice. He said, you know, you could stay and get a PhD if you want. He says, but I wouldn't recommend it unless you're absolutely sure that you want a PhD. And, you know, I wasn't completely sure. So I decided to go out and work for a few years. Now, when I did go back for the PhD, I had no plans for an academic career. I mainly wanted to do it so that later on in life, when I got to be this age, I wouldn't look back and wonder what my life would have been like if I had gotten that PhD. So this was in 1977. I think it was the world's first energy crisis. You know, there were gas lines everywhere. There was a lot of interest in solar energy. I ended up at Purdue with Richard Schwartz. He had invented the interdigitated back contact solar cell. That's a design that's now widely used. Solar cell efficiencies then were 17%. And during that time, there was a lot of really fundamental work done on recombination processes and band gap narrowing and how you trap light in thin semiconductor layers. And all of that really very fundamental work set the stage for the 25% efficiencies that we have in silicon solar cells today. So that was very satisfying. I learned numerical device simulation by solving the semiconductor equations for solar cells. I had to teach myself because my advisor didn't have any experience with this, but he was a really good device physicist. And we sat down together and pored over the results of the simulation and had a great time understanding what those simulations were telling us.
So what was your first job after you graduated? If I remember correctly, you joined in the industry.
I did. I joined Hewlett-Packard, and the facility was in Loveland, Colorado, near Fort Collins. I joined a division called the Desktop Computer Division. We were making desktop computers. This is before the PC. We were making desktop computers and selling a few of them to engineers. We didn't think anyone else would want a desktop computer. And at that time, you know, integrated circuit processes were manufacturing lines were very common. You know, almost every company had one. So I joined a process development team. We were developing a 5-micron NMOS process. So today we'd call that a 5,000 nanometer process. It was called NMOS 2 because it was the second process in the facility. The first one was a 7-micron process. So 5 microns is 7 microns divided by the square root of 2. So we were on Moore's Law, but we didn't think about it very much. We didn't think about how long it would last. We just thought about making our 5-micron process work. And I learned so much about material science and chemistry and device physics. Ion implantation was pretty new at that time. So was dry etching. So I had a chance to work on all of that. Short channel effects, people were dealing with them for the very first time. So we were struggling with that. And, you know, none of this was in the textbooks. You know, it all is now. But that short experience in industry was really helpful in my subsequent career. Doing my PhD was easy after that. I sort of developed the idea that, you know, if there was a solution to a problem, I was going to find it, you know, and that gave me the confidence I needed when I went back to my PhD. And I, you know, I think it's unfortunate that most academics today don't have that experience of working in industry. I found it was only a few years, but it was really valuable for me. It was exciting. The pace was very fast. You know, we were advancing the state of the art and there were lots of problems to solve. We'd have a hunch, we'd run some split plots. We'd try to solve the problem as quickly as we could and then move on to the next one. But you know, what frustrated me was that there was no time really to think deeply and understand the problems. There was always another one to solve. And but we were doing a lot of good and it was an exciting thing to do. When I went back into for my PhD, the idea was that I would go right back into industry and continuing to do that kind of technology development.
And the industrial experience, it's in a layman's perspective, it's kind of if I'm not cooking and then I am giving expert comments on the culinary art, it's going to be completely fatal in the sense, exactly the same way that many time we need to actually know about what is really happening so that we can compare that, are we really making progress or not? And I have told you many times before that whenever I have time, your lectures are in my iPad. I have downloaded them for many, many years. The question then comes that what really inspired you to take electron device as your passion?
Well, pretty much it was an accident, I guess. I mean, who knows how these things come about? You know, when I was in high school, I was tinkering around with amateur radio, ham radio. And when I had to choose a major for college, I decided to choose electrical engineering because I thought, this is cool. I'll be able to understand how these things really work. And maybe I'll end up with a job where I can get paid for doing my hobby. I thought that would be pretty neat. But in college, I got really interested in physics, almost to the point where I was considering changing my major. You know, but then I was introduced to semiconductors by some of my instructors. Albert van der Ziel, Ray Warner was another pioneer in semiconductor manufacturing. And, you know, all of these people were trained as physicists. We had, at that time, EE was very close to physics. We had quantum mechanics and thermodynamics and statistical mechanics taught in EE. And I decided that the semiconductor physics and electrical engineering was sort of the right combination for me. It satisfied my interest in physics, but it was also sort of the applied engineering type of thing that I was looking for.
We are very much familiar with what you have done with overall understanding of our classical MOSFETs, but at the same time, you have gradually evolved the overall practice of understanding the physics of semiconductor MOSFETs to the nanoscale transistors. You have been acquainted and worked a lot on the energy harvesting devices, including solar cells, as well as in the recent past on thermoelectric generators. You have looked into the emerging materials like carbon nanotubes in the past in collaboration. And also, I would say a temperature sensor. That was a major part of your work when during your graduate study, if I know correctly. So my question is that there is, maybe I'm missing one or two, but this is a very complex question for many, that if you are being asked to choose one of the work that you consider that it has driven me, that I was really, really passionate to do all this, to explore this, and it has gone to a level which I feel that, yes, this is where I wanted to take it to. Which one that would be?
Well, I'll have to stop and think about it. That's kind of a broad question, looking back over my whole career. Whoops.
That is fine. Take your time.
Oops. You know, when I think about it, you know, what has my career been about? It's largely been about trying to understand how carrier transport plays out in the context of semiconductor devices. One of them is, you know, as devices get smaller and smaller and smaller, how does transport change, and how do we understand this? Coupled with that was a lot of work on detailed numerical simulation. But I think what I'm most proud of is the way we tried to develop insights and understanding from those simulations, and then communicate them back to the broader community in a way that people could understand what was happening and make use of it in their own work. So, you know, I guess the work on understanding transport in the nanoscale MOSFET was probably the most interesting part of all of that. Because, you know, as MOSFET channels kept getting smaller and smaller, the transport physics got more and more complicated. Things like velocity overshoot came into play. Drift diffusion equations broke down. We needed Monte Carlo or hydrodynamic equations. The modeling got more and more complex. You know, but as we looked at that, the key insight that we came up with was that it was actually quite simple, that the current was controlled by what happened at the source, you know, where the electric field was low, and that was a bottleneck, and that all of this complicated velocity overshoot in a well-designed transistor was only a second-order effect. And I wrote a short electron device letters trying to explain that. The main criticism from the reviewers was that it was a nice little paper, but it was so simple that even an undergraduate could understand it. And my response to the editor was, well, that's the whole point. We're just making this too complicated. And that little paper ended up being one of my most highly cited papers. And I think complementing detailed simulations, but understanding them and conveying them simply in an insightful way, that's what I'm most proud of.
Many places where the students, they still go to your lectures, they read the books. You have a habit of, when you are producing a new lectures, new course you are designing, immediately after you follow up with the lecture notes in a way that even if someone didn't attend the course, when reads those lecture notes, they are written in a book format, they as if they are immediately sitting in that class discussing with you. The whole objective of simplification, I think that has been the goal of engineering. And when you connect that with the physics, then it rationalizes the whole process. And is there any specific memory you would like to share? Maybe that involves your former students or postdoc.
Yeah, well, there are so many good memories. Let me explain, you know, just one that comes to mind. Not an advisor, but an instructor that I had. When I was taking my first graduate level semiconductor device course from a professor, Alan Nussbaum, at the University of Minnesota. He was trained as a physicist, and we were doing sort of the standard graduate level semiconductor device course. And we got to a point called the law of the junction, you know, a forward bias PN junction. You know, when I teach this now to my students, it maybe takes 15, 20 minutes. That's all there is really to talk about. But back in 1973, people were still arguing about how valid this was. You know, are the quasi-Fermi levels really flat across a forward bias field junction? You know, how do you justify all of this? And Professor Nussbaum really dove into this. We read papers that were being published. He explained to us why he thought they were all wrong. And we got stuck on this question for the rest of the semester and never got through the rest of the course. We just talked about the law of the junction. As I said, when I teach it now, it maybe it justifies 15 minutes on the topic. But what that taught me was what it means to think deeply about a problem and really dive in and understand it in all of its nuances and subtleties. And I guess I discovered that that's the kind of person I am. I like to think deeply about problems.
Since the time of Archimedes, this question came up. Was there any specific eureka moment?
Well, you know, what could I say there? You know, this was sort of a eureka moment. You know, after the first 15 years or so of my career, I was working on carrier transport and solar cells and in bipolar transistors. And I came to a point where I just didn't know what to do next. And I was sort of losing my enthusiasm for taking the next step. This was also a time in the late 1990s when channel lengths were about 250 nanometers. People started getting convinced that we were at the end of Moore's Law. And, you know, I said to my friends in the industry, yes, we've heard this before, but it always continues. And they told me, well, yes, Mark, but this time it really is different. There's just a convergence of factors. They relate to manufacturing costs and design costs. And it just makes it so difficult to continue downscaling. You know, we're pretty much at the end of Moore's Law. I didn't know, you know, what's the future of electronics? Where can I go? So I came up with this idea that I would organize a workshop on the future of electronics. And I would invite all of the best people to come. And we would talk about this for a couple of days. And I did that. Surprisingly, everyone agreed to come. We talked about a lot of this. I don't know what other people took out of that meeting, but I left that meeting absolutely convinced that device downscaling would continue for another decade or two or three. It was just too important to let it stop. You know, no effort would be, you know, every effort would be made to just keep Moore's Law going. And I also realized that MOSFETs would shrink to the molecular scale, that they would pose some really interesting device physics questions. I realized that people like my colleague, Ciprio Dada, who had been working to understand the IV characteristics of single molecules, had developed a sort of conceptual understanding and computational techniques like non-equilibrium Green's function simulations that could be applied to conventional devices like transistors. And then we had the ability to look forward 10 or 20 years to 10 nanometer channel lengths or 5 nanometer and see what MOSFETs would look like. So I wrote all of this up in the report of the workshop. The Semiconductor Research Corporation was one of the sponsors. They asked me, Mark, do you mind if we use this report as the basis for a call for proposals? I said, sure, feel free. There was a call for proposals. I wrote a proposal and it was funded. And really, I think all of the subsequent success that I had in the next 20 years of my career came from that workshop when I realized this is not going to stop and this field is going to get really, really interesting. And I just dove into it at that point.
Did you ever think that, no, I should have tried something else?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. I don't know what else I might have chosen. Maybe a lawyer because I like to argue, you know. I feel really lucky to have played a small part in the development of, you know, one of the most impactful technologies in human history. So, you know, I feel lucky I made the choice that I did. But there's this very famous poem by Robert Frost called The Road Not Taken. You know, there's a line in that that says, two roads diverged in a wood. I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. You know, and that leaves people with the idea that you have to make the right decision, otherwise you'll regret it later. You know, but people say that we're misinterpreting that poem, that whichever decision you make, you know, if you pursue it with passion and work hard, near the end of your career, you'll look back and you'll think, boy, was I lucky I made that choice. And I think if I had chosen something else, I would have been looking back at this age thinking, boy, I was really lucky to have made that choice.
The theme of Professor Lundstrom's career has been to understand the flow of charge and heat by electrons and phonons to convey understanding developed in research to researchers, engineers, and students. This student-friendly book, Fundamentals of Carrier Transport, is a standard reference. In 2000, he created the NanoHub, https://nanohub.org, which subsequently became a major online resource where thousands have viewed tutorials, seminars, and courses by Lundstrom and his colleagues. In 2012, Lundstrom created NanoHub U, https://nanohub.org/U, to provide short courses on topics not yet widely available. To complement NanoHub U, he established the Lessons from Nanoscience Lecture Notes series. These low-cost texts aim to rethink the way that traditional topics are taught so that working from nanoscale to the system scale is seamless and intuitive. Professor Lundstrom's contributions to teaching and mentoring graduate students have been recognized by the ASEE Thurman Award 1993, the Electron Device Society's Education Award 2006, the Semiconductor Research Corporation's Aristotle Award 2012, and the IEEE Leon K. Kirchmeyer Graduate Teaching Award. Purdue has also recognized Professor Lundstrom's contribution to teaching and engagement with the A.A. Potter Best of Engineering Teachers Award 1996 and the Morrill Award 2012. Dr. Lundstrom is a Life Fellow of the IEEE, a Fellow of the American Physical Society, an American Association for the Advancement of Science, and a member of the United States National Academy of Engineering. During 2020, Professor Lundstrom served as acting dean of Purdue's College of Engineering. You famously coined this. You said that repurposing silicon electronics, but I would like to broaden this up and ask you, what is your thought about electronics in the future?
Yeah, you know, that's a tough question. I don't know. Predicting the future is difficult, other than that history tells us that we should be optimistic, and that I think semiconductor electronics driven by silicon is probably going to have a significantly higher, larger impact in the 21st century than it did in the 20th century. And that's really saying something. You know, I think it really is different today. There's this famous quote by Herb Kroemer, who said, any sufficiently novel device invents its own applications. And I sort of worked in the age of devices, where all you had to do was invent a novel device and applications would follow. You know, there are things like charge coupled devices, high electron mobility transistors, quantum well lasers, flash memories, MEMS. But I think it's different today. You know, we have a very sophisticated electronic infrastructure. And it's not about primarily about just inventing new devices. You have to complement or advance the infrastructure that we have. But you know, it really is interesting to think about, is there a device we haven't invented that could really change things and invent a whole new range of applications? So I don't know what the future looks like. You know, a relatively small number of people now work on materials and processing and device design. They support an enormous number of hardware engineers and an even bigger number of software engineers. all the things that are getting attention today, machine learning, autonomous systems, vehicles, everything, are all enabled by a small number of people doing materials and devices and semiconductor manufacturing and chip design. So those of us that have a passion on the physical side, we can take pride in the fact that although we're not in the limelight, we're enabling all these things that are in the limelight. Now, I do think there are opportunities for people who like to work close to the physical side, but who also understand the systems and applications that are driving everything today. People who understand both sides, the underlying technology and the systems, they're rare, and there should be opportunities for them.
Right. You remind me of a few years back in one of our IEDM RAMP session. This was the question that whether the software will drive the hardware or the other way around. From my perspective, as someone who works on the hardware side, on the physical electronics, that if because of the fact that we have a handheld smart phone, that's why we see Uber. That's why we see the proliferation of social media in our life, the e-commerce, many of those kind of things. But if we did not have a good device in our hand, many of the other applications or the so-called impactful utilities we would not have seen. And the reason that we have that kind of hardware is because at a core level, people like yourself have worked on understanding the physics, choosing the right materials, designing the right device, having the right sequence of integration, and then to qualify for its performance as well as the reliability. That's where we are building all the hardware. And then 15 years, we will be fine because there will be tons of new software-based, I would say, utilities, then applications, and then the economy. That's what we see. And not only economy, I think like just we take an example of the social media, then it has a lot of powerful, both debatable impact in our society. And not exactly related, I don't want to influence the response, but the question is that does anything that strike your mind today which seems like it could have been better?
Well, yeah, let me think about how to respond to that. I mean, one thing is I think we need to rethink how we educate and train semiconductor technologists, especially those who work at the interface between technology and systems. You know, in my day, semiconductor technology was very close to physics. We attended physics conferences. We published in the physics literature. But today it's more and more about systems and applications. How do we give semiconductor technologists a non-trivial understanding of material science, physics, and chemistry that they need, but also an understanding of systems and data science and machine learning, the things that are driving the applications of semiconductor technology today? So how do we prepare students with the breadth they need, but also the depth that they need to advance the state of the art in their own field? This is a real challenge that we need to think about.
Yes, there's a whole lot of issues about the education side, especially in the graduate study. There are logistics, but definitely that component is kind of missing more and more for the students to inspire them to go deeper, not to just to be in the survey level courses where the breadth is quite there, but really to go a little bit deeper into so that they can probe, they can utilize that learning into their research to have a better analysis of what they're observing, what they're experimenting with. So you made a fantastic comment. You said that, have we discovered or have we invented a new device? Because a new interesting device, a flash memory, can have a whole lot of applications. Is there any particular application that you can think of that does not exist today, but you are wishing for?
Well, I could mention one, and maybe it's because I'm getting older. You know, I'd like to see machine learning develop the capability to create digital twins of people. So I don't know, maybe people are working on this. So you could start with me. So everything I know about carrier transport and materials and devices, including the way I think about problems, has been documented in papers and books and online videos and several different places. So the question is, after I'm gone, could my digital twin continue to function? You know, could it answer questions and give advice? Could it even do creative research on problems that I haven't seen? You know, so if it could be done for me, you know, then maybe we could do it for Albert Einstein, and Richard Feynman, and Andy Grove, Claude Shannon, and people like that. You know, what if these great engineers and scientists could become immortal and continue to advance science and engineering? That's kind of interesting to think about. Maybe artificial intelligence and machine learning might make this possible.
I think that's fascinating vision. And I believe that we will get closer and closer. We might not completely replicate the way you think, the way that human mind basically works with so many different variables and tries to make the best possible decision under given circumstance. But that is a fascinating vision. And hopefully all the different components one day will be plugged together and we can see that. We would like to see you to actually stay with us for many, many, many years to decades and can actually share all the perspectives you have. Those are fascinating. That is the most important part. What is your one piece of advice for the younger generation?
The only one, you know, when you get to my age, you know, I might be tempted to say, choose good parents, you know, and while that makes success easier, it's probably not absolutely essential. I think, you know, the key thing is that you can't control the events and the things that life throws at you, but you can control how you react to them. And my advice is always move forward. If a door slams in your face, look around, you'll find another one open, you know, go through that one. Just continue to take small steps forward. And, you know, they accumulate like compound interest. If you just look for ways to continue to move forward, be optimistic, look for opportunities, they're always there. And we're really lucky, I think, in the US, because if you're determined to succeed, there's virtually no one who can stop you.
I think this is the side that some of us know who have talked to you, who have worked with you quite frequently. We have been very fortunate, but let's open it up for the others. So it's kind of a rapid fire round. Although I will say that we prefer to have a one word answer, but there is no way that I will be restricting you. So it's your choice, okay? Whenever you're ready.
I'm ready. Let's go.
Okay. What are your hobbies?
Yeah. Well, these days I waste a lot of time on my motorcycles. You know, I have two, a Harley Davidson and an Indian. These are the two iconic American motorcycles.
I am just like, you know, I have seen that photo and thanks for sharing it with me. And I'm pretty sure many people are going to be completely pleasantly surprised seeing that. Next time, every time I see a group of those bikers on the Harley Davidson, I would definitely look for you. Music or movie, which one you enjoy more?
You know, I enjoy them both. You know, and as far as movies go, you know, I enjoy the sort of old fashioned ones that tell a good story about interesting real people, right?
What is the book you are reading now?
You know, I'm reading a book called Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. And I'm told that if you read one Western novel, this is the one you should read.
Yeah, I think there was a series or something like that, or a movie out of it, The Lonesome Dove. Yeah, I heard about it. I think I was very young at that point.
I think it was a TV miniseries, actually. Right?
Correct. Correct. Right. That's what I heard. What is your favorite cuisine?
Oh, you know, I pretty much enjoy everything, except possibly Thai food. Probably my favorites are Italian and Indian food.
Any sports you enjoy? You said a lot what you did in your childhood. Now you ride a lot. Yeah. Anything beyond that?
Yeah, I don't really play any sports. I try to get my 10,000 steps every day. And right now, this time of year in winter, I watch a lot of Big Ten basketball because it helps when you are stuck inside in the winter.
What is your favorite travel spot?
Well, I might say anywhere my motorcycle takes me. But, you know, overseas, it's Italy, just because the scenery is so beautiful and it has such interesting history and good food. And I have some good friends there. Lots of good memories that my wife and I took on our trips to Italy.
Last question, this was not listed. Is there anything that you wanted to tell but I didn't ask you?
Oh gosh, we've covered an awful lot of ground. I think you've asked a lot of good questions. Thanks for the opportunity just to sharing this time with you.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.